Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This morning we're going to read texts 50 through 55, and we'll chant together text 50. Lobda ka vipine kaschit pakshinam nirmiton taka vitatya jalam vidadhe tatra tatra palobhayam lobda ka vipine kaschit pakshinam nirmitontaka vitatya jalam vidadhe tatra tatra palobhayan. Lobhakaha hunter vipine in the forest. Kaschit, some. Pakshinam, of birds. Nirmitaha, appointed. Antakaha, killer. Vitatya, spreading. Jalam, a net. Vidadhe, captured. Tatra tatra, here and there. Pralobhayan, luring with food. Translation: there was once a hunter who lured birds with food and captured them after spreading a net. He lived as if appointed by death personified as the killer of birds. Report. This is another incident from the histories. Text 51. While wandering in the forest, the hunter saw a pair of Kalinga birds. Of the two, the female was captured by the hunter's lure. O queens of Suyagya, the male Kalinga bird, seeing his wife put into great danger in the grip of providence, became very unhappy because of affection. The poor bird, being unable to release her, began to lament for his wife. Alas, how merciless is providence! My wife, unable to be helped by anyone, is in such an awkward position and lamenting for me. What will providence gain by taking away this poor bird? What will be the profit? If unkind providence takes away my wife, who is half my body, why should he not take me also? What is the use of my living with half of my body, bereaved by loss of my wife? What shall I gain in this way? The unfortunate baby birds, bereft of their mother, are waiting in the nest for her to feed them. They are still very small and have not yet grown their wings. How shall I be able to maintain them? Purport. The bird is lamenting for the mother of his children because the mother naturally maintains and cares for the children. Yamaraj, however, in the guise of a small boy, has already explained that although his mother left him uncared for and wandering in the forest, the tigers and other ferocious animals had not eaten him. The real fact is that if the Supreme Personality of Godhead protects one, even though one be motherless and fatherless, one can be maintained by the goodwill of the Lord. Otherwise, if the Supreme Lord does not give one protection, One must suffer in spite of the presence of his father and mother. Another example is that sometimes a patient dies in spite of a good physician and good medicine. Thus, without the protection of the Lord, one cannot live with or without parents. And paragraph. Another point in this verse is that fathers and mothers have protective feelings for their children, even in bird and beast society, not to speak of human society. Kali Yuga, however, is so degraded that a father and mother even kill their children in the womb on the plea of their scientific knowledge that within the womb the child has no life. Prestigious medical practitioners give this opinion, and therefore the father and mother of this day kill their children within the womb. How degraded human society has become! Exclamation point. Their scientific knowledge is so advanced that they think that within the egg and the embryo there is no life. Now, these so-called scientists are receiving Nobel Prizes for advancing the theory of chemical evolution. But if chemical combinations are the source of life, why don't the scientists manufacture something like an egg through chemistry and put it in an incubator so that a chicken will come out? Question mark. What is their answer? Challenge. With their scientific knowledge, they are unable to create even an egg. Such scientists are described in Bhagavad Gita as mayaya parita jnana, fools whose real knowledge has been taken away. They are not men of knowledge, but they pose as scientists and philosophers, although their so-called theoretical knowledge cannot produce practical results. Though many nice points we can discuss. A few preliminary points. I find it interesting that how the Bhagavatam is constructed. This is what the person narrating this is, Narada Muni. Narada Muni is having a discussion with Maharaj Yudhisthira. And the person that's narrating that is Shukadeva Goswami to Maharaj Pariksit about Narada having a conversation with Yudhisthira, about Hiranyakashipu having a discussion with his relatives, his mother and the wife of his brother and his brother's children. And in the course of that, it's a narration of a young boy who's having a discussion about the conversation between the hunter and Klingabirds. And who knows, there's maybe other layers besides that. So, and Prabhupada, the short little one sentence purport at the beginning is, this isn't a fiction, necessarily. It's a description from, the histories. The histories means the Puranas. So Puranic literature, just two things about the Puranic literature. They're histories. They're not fiction. There's an exception. And one of the exceptions, for example, is Narada speaking to King Prajini and Bari, and it's a allegory. And some people take the whole of the Puranic literature as allegorical or fiction, intended to teach people lessons. Simple people that can't understand philosophy, so they need a story, and then they can understand the philosophy. It's just the story is fiction. It's to help them understand a lesson or some philosophy. Well, not so, that they're actual histories. Another interesting point is these histories, according to, I've been spending some time preparing for a seminar on Tattva Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, and one of the references he makes is that not only these Puranas are present in a vastly expanded form on the heavenly planets, which means there's more histories to be heard and told than what we have, but moreover, two references that say that when Narayana presents the Vedas, along with the Vedas, he presents the Puranas. It's not like they were created by a man to embellish or elucidate the philosophy. So, you know, there's histories before they even happen. You get the point? Like, for example, Valmiki. He wrote Ramayana before Lord Ram even appeared. He described the pastimes of Ram before they happened. How is that possible? Because they're eternal pastimes. It's like a rerun. No, in our modern paradigm. But, you know, even the rerun isn't inflexible. When the Lord performs his pastimes, they're variegated. Sometimes he does this and sometimes he does that. There's a theme, and the theme is specific to bhava or emotion, transcendental exchange of love. But sometimes he does this way and sometimes he does that way, because Prabhupada teaches variety is the mother of pleasure or happiness. So he's variegated, although there's the spool, to term that Prabhupada would use, like, you know, in the previous methodology of filmmaking, films were little images connected to one another, run through a projector, and so it was all placed on a spool. So he used that, like spool. A spool is what you put thread on, you know, a spool. So similarly, in the film industry, that, you know, the spool of film passed things through. Giriraj Maharaj told me of an exchange between himself and Srila Prabhupada about using the same imagery of spool, like, you know, Giriraj Maharaj. This is, you know, Boston 1970 or 69 or something like that, when Giriraj Maharaj was just, you know, becoming acquainted with Krishna consciousness, and Prabhupada used this example. He wanted to understand what's reality, you know, absolute reality. And Prabhupada was using this metaphor of a projector and a spool, and projecting an image on the silver screen. It used to be called the silver screen. And, you know, the image on the screen is not reality, but we take that to be reality. And even the spool is not reality. Krishna is reality. But when he performs his pastimes, it's not like the reflection on the silver screen. It's reality, and he's manifesting that reality. He descends and he performs pastimes. And there is the possibility, as Valmiki demonstrated, and as discussed in Sri Brahma Samhita, that there is in elevated states of Krishna consciousness, the unmanifested pastimes can not only be seen, but one can enter into them if one is spiritually qualified, as are Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami and Raghunath Das Goswami and others had the capacity to enter into the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, the pastimes that we can't see. Janava Mata is another example. So these aren't fiction. This is, and so Hiranyakashipu, he's a demon. And isn't it interesting that here's a demon giving transcendental knowledge? Isn't it interesting? There's the position of the Vedas where knowledge brings detachment. Jnana Vairagya is a standard couplet in Vedic terminology. Jnana Vairagya. It's in Bhagavad Gita too. Knowledge, detachment. Nasate vijate bhavo na bhavo vijate sataha ubiyor apidrishton tastvanios tattvadarshi bihi. To be a tattvadarshi, you're detached. You're detached from, you know, the silver screen. You're detached from maya. You're detached from the illusion. And so, what's the attempt? The attempt of Hiranyakashipu is through knowledge to bring detachment to help his mother, Diti, and the wife of his brother, Hiranyaksha, to, and the children of Hiranyaksha and his wife, to feel relief of their distress through knowledge. You know, the soul is eternal. Same as Krishna says to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. Same. The details are different, but the principle is the same. Detachment through knowledge. Don't lament the soul is eternal. Hiranyaksha has gone to some other place because the soul is eternal. And, you know, the way of nature is things are brought together. It happens many times when transcendental knowledge is presented. Just like for example is when Angira and Narada are pacifying King Chitraketu after the loss of their son, or his son, Harshashoka. Here's just a few of them. They're all nice. One is the movement of the waves of the ocean. As they churn, they uproot seaweed that's at the bottom of the ocean. And those same waves then bring clumps of seaweed together with other clumps of seaweed, and they intertangle. And the same churning of the waves separate the clumps of seaweed. So we don't lament, oh, the clumps of seaweed separated. It happens. Or another direct example is sometimes in some places there's a well where there's fresh water, and so the ladies of the village come to the place with their vessels for carrying the water, and in the morning they gather together and they have some conversation as they're gathering the water, and they go back to their homes and they separate. They come together and they separate. Or another example is an inn. This is directly from the Bhagavatam. Persons come together at an inn. We don't have that, you know, like an eating place. And then they associate together and they go their separate way. Then there's another one. The waves bring particles of sand together, and the same waves separate the particles of sand. It's, you know, time is moving events, and time continues to move events. So time brings things together and time separates things. Duly lament when particles of sand separate from other particles of sand? No. So knowledge helps. There's potency. There's potency in knowledge. The potencies of knowledge is it induces detachment. So the converse is there. If one is in ignorance, then there's attachment. So knowledge helps detachment. And so that's what Hiranyakashipu is doing. He's giving knowledge. And then there's another nice lesson about giving knowledge. And that is, sometimes examples help. So instead of just, you know, be detached because you're not this body, then there's a story. Because exactly, this is the role of the Puranas. It's illustrating a philosophical idea. So the philosophical idea, let's say, that's enshrined in the one of the places is the Upanishads. To help understand the message, there's a description, historical description, that helps one understand the message. So the message is embedded within the narration. There's potency in the narration because there's the deliverance potency of knowledge. It can deliver one to liberation, at least, or at utmost, let's say. Just knowledge. The best fruit is moksha. Identification of self with Brahman. At least, if one received knowledge from the proper source and receptive manner, it can lead to detachment from the grief of material circumstances of life that are perplexing because we're attached. That, you know, our affinity for matter is so strong. Devahuti, the little section in the third canto of Bhagavatam, where Devahuti is hearing knowledge and detachment from her son, Kapiladev, an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. And she's heard the whole Sankhya thing, details. And then he goes on to describe how to practically live it, how to live your life with detachment while continuing the activities of life. And ultimately become fixed in super soul realization and ultimately, depending upon the quality of that super soul realization, achieving liberation. So Devahuti has a doubt, which is a nice practical sense doubt. She says, wait a minute. I get it. You know, the soul is different than matter, but they're so interwoven with one another that, okay, detachment through knowledge, I get it. But then they're so interwoven that it's just a matter of time until, again, because they're so mingled, that the propensity of the soul to identify with matter will take place, and the potency then of matter to bewilder and delude the living entity will happen again, and one is in the same position again. I call it the bungee cord phenomena. Just goes right back to the same position again, however you may, you know, feel detached for some time. And we all experience that, you know, the unsteadiness of consciousness because of the tendency to be attached. We're so inextricably involved. And so she says to Kapiladev, what to do? Is it possible? And his answer is, of course it's possible. And there's a special potency in bhakti that dissolves the very instrument that carries the attachment. It dissolves the mind and the false ego. The potency is there. But unless we go that far, we're in this unsteady position, sometimes and sometimes. So what's happening here, back to Hiranyakashipu, he's giving knowledge that the purpose of which is detachment. My dear family members, don't continue to bereave like the queens of Suyogya were bereaving over Suyogya's death, because time is going to come and take them away too. Don't be caught in that bereaving of the loss of something temporary, nor attached to something temporary. It's both sides of the sword. And to help them understand, the queens, he's now narrating the story of a young boy that comes onto the field. And he describes his position as one who doesn't have mother and father, but he's also protected, although he has no mother and father. And then he tells them, the boy, this is really nice, little boys telling stories. The same thing that an adult might say, there's something very powerful in a child saying it. people go, wow. Anyway, I could give some anecdotal story, but I won't. When children say something, people go, wow. They pay attention for some reason. Not just they're cute, but when you hear knowledge from a small-bodied person, it goes in. So, therefore, he's using that principle to help his DT and the relatives of his brother. Here, the Suyagya story, and then here comes this little boy that then tells the queens. Now that's where we are with this. So there's this hunter who is as if appointed by death personified as a bird killer. And that's his program. He kills birds. Like Putana killed babies. That was her program. So this hunter, he kills birds. And then this lamentation of the male bird about the female bird. And not so dissimilar. I mean, it's in the bird species, but I've heard this kind of grief from persons who are considering the misfortune and the ill designed program of Providence, God, to take away the life of someone. In this case, it's the wife, but sometimes it's the husband, or sometimes it's the children. And, you know, what is to be gained? You know, the search for meaning behind events of life. Common. So, what Prabhupada is doing in the purport, I'll just go there, but, you know, it's even additional besides the purpose that Hiranyakashipu is narrating these. And what Prabhupada covers in the purport is, if Krishna protects one, no one can harm one. If Krishna doesn't protect one, no one can, if Krishna wants to kill someone, no one can protect them. In other words, the real protector is not the mother and father, or anyone else except the Supreme Lord. He's the real protector. Of course, Hiranyakashipu isn't saying the Supreme Lord is the real protector because he's a demon. So, like, question. How can one who has transcendental knowledge, very clearly, this is transcendental knowledge, just as Angira and Narada are presenting to King Chitraketu, same Hiranyakashipu is giving to his relatives. He has transcendental knowledge. So why do we call him a demon? He's a big demon. He's got transcendental knowledge. He believes in the soul. He's teaching about the soul. He's teaching the distinction between the soul and matter. And be attached to spirit. Well, he's a demon on one principle only, his attitude towards the personality of God. Because as soon as he finishes all of this, he then turns his attention to Lord Vishnu, saying, he's the one who killed my brother, so I'm going to get him. I take a vow, I'm going to kill him. Which really doesn't make any sense at all. At all. At all. Doesn't make any sense at all. But that's, you know, knowledge, mayaya pratigyana, his knowledge is stolen by illusion. He has knowledge, but his knowledge is stolen by illusion because of his regard for the Supreme. And that's the distinction between divine and demoniac. And with demoniac, that's one thing, regard for the Supreme, then so many undesirable qualities come about as a result of that regard for the Supreme, or, you know, the ill disposition towards the Supreme. Then bad qualities come, and the converse, good qualities come. That's exactly what the Bhagavatam teaches. All the good qualities of the demigods become manifest in the person who takes shelter of the personality of God, and those who don't do not have good qualities or not any sustainable good qualities, let's say. You know, that again, it's like the distinction between reality and the silver screen. And when, you know, people watch movies, they cry when there's some bad thing. They feel fear when it's a horror movie or whatever, you know, the thing is. And they feel passion when they see, you know, action movies. They call it action movies, just violence. They feel lusty when they see lusty scenes. You know, feelings are churned by the silver screen, but it's not reality. And their emotions are not reality. It's just that it's the three modes of material nature mixing with the 24 elements producing illusion. And so there's the movie, and then there's the movie, and then there's reality. Now, it's a nice philosophical question. What's reality? And virtual reality. Is virtual, Sariputta used to discuss this. You know, they have, now it's, the technology has really developed virtual reality lenses, and so is that virtual reality lens any less real or more real than the reality of what we experience? You know, from an absolute perspective, they're both illusion. And that, you know, the philosophers that don't know what absolute reality is, they're busy speculating about this reality and that reality and what's reality and become impersonalists. The second part of the purport, you know, real protection comes from the Supreme Lord. That's the emphasis in the first paragraph. And the second paragraph is the scientists, Prabhupada, made it a major part of his mission. And we should be very, very careful how we, you know, recreate that message when we're speaking to persons. If we're immature, you know, will not enhance the reputation of the Hare Krishna movement and our founder Acharya. But Prabhupada could speak this way, and he spoke this way very strongly. So in our own way, we can also consider how to speak the message that the scientists say chemical evolution. Some say, some don't say. And those that say that, then we can invite them or challenge them. Like Prabhupada repeated many times that Bhaktisrupa Damodara Maharaj did that as a scientist in a convention where someone was speaking on chemical evolution, and it was question-answer time. And Bhaktisrupa Damodara Maharaj said, so I heard, he repeated the message, I heard you speaking about chemical evolution. Life comes from chemicals. So if I gave you the chemicals, can you as a scientist create life? You know, blah, blah. Is it practical? That's exactly what Prabhupada is saying. The so-called theoretical knowledge cannot produce practical results. You're saying, can you do it? What you're saying? That I cannot say was the answer. He wasn't honest enough to say, no, we can't, that I cannot say. And that was, you know, that period of time in our Hare Krishna movement where, as a theme, Prabhupada was repeating, life comes from life, and so a book was made, life comes from life, not life comes from matter. And at least for those of us who are cultivating Krishna consciousness, practicing bhakti, we should be very clear. We may or may not be so expert in presenting to those that have a different conviction, but we should have clear understanding. Life comes from life. And so that's the essence of life, is the presence of the soul. Then comes the next, because Hiranyakashipu has that understanding also. But then the soul's journey is directed by the Supreme Soul. It leads to God realization. In the whole of the Sankhya philosophy, same. By that I mean all of this detailed description of matter and the subtleties of matter influencing other more subtle forms of matter, and the whole thing unfolds. And the summary at the end of all of that detailed description is the purpose of this is detachment, and the purpose of the detachment, since we belong to the category of spirit, is then directing attention to the supersoul. That's where the train is going. Get on board. That's the destination. Fixing the mind upon supersoul. And then further, fixing the mind upon supersoul, engaging in devotional service to the Supreme Person, Bhagavan. So, Brahman Paramatma Bhagavan. The goal is devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And living one's life in practical ways with Bhagavan as the object of our meditation. But there must be. In Prabhupada's language in Bhagavad Gita, there must be not just theoretical, but practical, beyond the point where there's even a chance of engaging in fruitive activities based upon the bodily conception of life. That's where we need to go. We're not going to get to Prema Bhakti if we don't get that one. We make, like this nice example, if you make a long mathematical calculation, you're going to get the wrong answer if you made an error way in the beginning. We have to get the, beginning calculation right, and then subsequently do the rest of the calculations. So it's imperative. Therefore, even in the seventh, in so many places, here in the seventh canto, there's instruction given by Sri Hiranyakashipu about transcendental knowledge. No, it doesn't stop there, but it's necessary. We're not this body. And therefore, we are to not lament over the circumstances of the body. And whatever the affairs are in the material world, they're under the sanction of the Supreme Lord. He is our protector. We should take shelter of him. That's the devotional impetus. He just doesn't go that far. In fact, he goes the opposite direction. So knowledge is necessary, but not sufficient. Knowledge alone is not enough. Knowledge must be also combined, or as a stepping stone to devotion, taking shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. To be continued tomorrow by Bhadra Narayan Swami. He'll take you the next step. Any comments or questions? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. When we should expect the Lord's mercy, is this...
Somehow I can't hear you.
Now I can hear you. When we think of the Lord's protection, should we view it as a material protection or spiritual or both or
one both.
Or the other? Both.
Comprehensive protection. Comprehensive policy. Now, material protection doesn't mean you'll never stub your toe or never have a headache or never have a hip replacement or something. You'll never have a bodily pain in the world. That's not, you know, the material protection. The greatest danger is the protection. Forgetfulness of Krishna is the greatest danger. And when there's that greatest danger, you know, depending upon the Lord's plan for us, it may look like, but like, you know, Maharaj Pariksit, he died by a material arrangement, a mystical thing. But we're all going to die, so he died that way. It's not the promise we'll never die or ever have any misfortune. That's not that kind of material protection. But auspiciousness in the material plane for furthering our progress in Krishna consciousness. That kind of material protection. That which leads to, or, you know, the path to Krishna is made open, although it may look like adversity or something else awful. Material protection. Something else. You get to carry the baton to the next person. So, your question?
Hi, Krishna. I wanted to ask a question about, like, the seaweed coming together.
About what?
The seaweed
coming together and then separating, okay.
Yeah, so I think you were making that reference to, like, family coming together and will be taken apart.
Guaranteed.
And also, I have a question about, like, devotees coming together and coming apart.
Guaranteed.
Should we prepare ourselves? Should we be detached from devotees, or should we
detach? That's not question. Like I don't care about you because, you know, I may not have your association after some time, so I'm going to be detached from you. No. There's, you know, the spiritual connection, the spiritual merit of that relationship will stay with you. But time moves things. That's what happens here. Even in the spiritual world, there's separation. So it's not like the gopis think, well, I better not get attached to Krishna because it's going to happen that, you know, he's not going to be here forever. You know, he's going to go with the cowherd boys and herd the cows. So I better not get attached to Krishna. So it's Queen Kunti's advice is let us sustain or focus on the spiritual dimension of attachment, and by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, the material aspect be removed. That takes advancement. So, you know, prepare ourselves for, you know, we're going to get, I'm not going to make any friends in the ashram because at some point in time, I'm not going to be here, they're not going to be here, we're all kaput or something like that, so I'm not going to get attached. And then I get this cold exterior. No. Look to the spiritual. Look to the spiritual dimension and lessons to be learned and the happiness of serving our founder Acharya and Krishna together. There's joy in that. And that'll stay with you. You gotta stand up and carry the baton. Okay. Here comes the challenge of the morning. Himanshu has these really deep questions. Then he has to ask the question a second time because it doesn't get addressed.
Hey, Krishna Maharaj.
I like it. I'm not... Go ahead.
You know me too well. In the first half of your class, you spoke about how knowledge leads to detachment. But Devavati was saying that...
It's not sufficient.
I'm feeling, at least what I'm observing in myself and also in the community of devotees, is devotees also struggle with this. They go through some emotional distress and lamentation.
Not just devotees, everyone.
Everyone.
Birds.
And you have the approach that Krishna takes in Gita, where he speaks about Jiva Tattva. And when Arjuna says, this is too difficult, Krishna says, you just learn to tolerate, you know, somehow. But when you're going through something and a devotee tells you, look, just learn to tolerate, you feel like it's a slap in the face or something, you know?
No, it's good advice.
It's good
Krishna's
advice.
Good advice.
So, how did I ask this question also in Bhagavatam class 2 days ago? But like, if you could speak a little about it, if you like.
Speak slowly.
How do you balance, because the ultimate solution is bhakti and the knowledge of devotion and a relationship with the Lord. But then we try to accommodate what they're experiencing, rightly so, based on where they're at. But then how do you balance the sort of immediate emotional needs with the long-term solution in a way that the person is actually, is there like an external way of sort of measuring that, okay, this person is actually moving in the right direction, or is it a matter of the individual involved who's giving the care, who kind of keeps an eye on that? I'm just not clear on this, because in my understanding was that as long as you're getting taste for hearing and chanting,
as long as
your taste for hearing and chanting is improving, then these other issues will be there, but because you have faith in the hearing and chanting, and that seems to be rising, these things will eventually just go away. That was my understanding. That was also my experience.
Okay.
Sometimes the idea may be there that perhaps we're bypassing our emotional needs.
When you speak real fast, it's really hard to follow what you're saying. I kind of get the idea, but yeah. Your questions are subtle, so please speak slowly.
Yes, Maharaj. The question really is this. Is it sufficient to just focus on an increase in our hearing and chanting? And
that's the objective. Okay, now let me respond. I've got three things to say. Turn it off for a second before you ask your second question. Follow up. Here's three or four things. One is, like Angira and Narada, they knew what the goal is, just as you iterated. But they didn't go there right away. Why? Here's a person that's too attached. So just a practical example of that in modern life. We have all this transcendental knowledge. Supposing there's a calamity, one situation in my mind right at the moment is, I was at someone's home in Houston, and the family, they had one son, a teenage son. He died in an automobile accident the day after I had a program at their home. He was at the program the day after he died. So we didn't go and, you know, give them a Bhagavad Gita class, chapter 2. We just were there for them because that's what they needed. That's what they could relate to. We know where the train, we want the thing to go to, but we didn't do that. Just kirtan and cooked for them, cleaned for them, did everything for them so they could, you know, have the space to manage their emotions. They felt support. And it went on like that for a week or 10 days. Now, those that did that for them, they felt such relief and, you know, support and, you know, a great, great appreciation for the persons who were, they didn't, you know, no Bhagavad Gita message, period. But kirtan just, you know, for the soothing of their emotion, because that they could relate to, and it wasn't, no discussion. We did a similar thing in New York City after 9/11. You've heard me describe this. Chandrasekhar Maharaj, one person went with harmonium, no talking, just one person singing softly with a little sign that said something. And, you know, if people want, 26 Second Avenue at 6 o'clock, we can go there for pastoral counseling or something like that, you know, counseling or, you know, grieving counseling, but, you know, just a passive invitation. Because that's, so, it's understanding so many other examples of people that you know that maybe it's not like a calamity kind of situation, but you evaluate what their capacity, and you don't crash through that capacity threshold. You connect with them on some level, and then based upon the relation of they feel understood, then proportionately you go the next step or the next step or the next step. But it's based upon the relationship of trust with that person. Now, supposing you're dealing with, go to, you know, like somebody that's in the community of young people that come to the temple, and they're already there, they're chanting, and, you know, they've heard many classes, and then something, attachment, something, without the, you know, whatever the something is. Then you have to very carefully consider what the relationship is, what the person's capacity is, the extent of their emotion, and then, you know, your own nature. You know, if you're Jai Jagannath, you might do something, and if you're Himanshu, you might do something else, because your natures are different. And, you know, but you have to evaluate all those factors. And then, part of it is super soul guiding, part of it is experience. You know, and then, depending upon the person, you can just go to what you just said. Really, Prabhu, let's take shelter of hearing and chanting. Let me support that, because that's the solution to everything. But if you go there right away, depending upon the circumstance, the person's going to think, you know, you don't understand me at all. You don't understand the grief that I'm going, whatever it is. They're not a connect. It's a disconnect notice. So depending. So, experience, supersoul, you know, those variables, the various factors you have to consider, and what the person can hear. It's exactly that the example is there within Narada and Angira. When he was ready, then they gave him more than transcendental knowledge, they gave him devotion. Not only they gave him devotion, they gave him means to achieve perfection. He achieved perfection like in the fast lane, because he was ready. But had they given that earlier, wouldn't have gone in. So we have to consider the circumstance and our capacity, our nature, the relationship. And even, you know, say, a given person, this circumstance, this is appropriate. Another time, another circumstance, that's appropriate. So we have to be very flexible. You know, so it's compassion for the well-being of the soul and delivering the soul to the lotus feet of Krishna. So different things are appropriate in different circumstances. We're going to hear all about that this weekend. Nityananda Pran, you have something? Oh, just scratching. Okay. Lakshmioni, anything you want to add to this? Okay. Anyone? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.